This week's contempt of court hearing involving Sheriff Joe Arpaio has had its share of surprises, including the revelation Arpaio's office investigated the judge's wife.
It's disturbing, to say the least. It's concerning. It certainly doesn't reflect well upon this agency.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, the latest on the drama. Also, Glendale considers selling its assets.
What's in a name for a dog?
And using canals to bring neighborhoods together.
Rather than walking along just this long linear set of masonry walls, being able to look in some of the backyards, almost like people that walk on sidewalks and looking at people on their front porches.
Plus, rolling out a new standardized test, and we wet down the slide.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody along with Steve Goldstein. We've seen some rain across the valley throughout the day. Chance we could see some more. We're looking for a high ultimately of 79 degrees. Partly cloudy skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the low to mid 60s. Partly cloudy skies for tomorrow with a 60% chance of afternoon rain and a high of 83. It's cloudy and 66 degrees right now. As you might imagine, given the weather, a lot of activity and accidents on valley freeways, including I-70 northbound at Peoria, an accident blocking the exit ramp there. I-10 westbound at Avondale, 202 westbound Red Mountain Freeway at the 51, and the 60 westbound at Priest. The right lane is blocked there. Fire managers in northern Arizona are planning a series of prescribed burns this weekend. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, officials plan to treat almost 5,000 acres of land in the Mormon Lake area near Flagstaff.
Weather permitting, the Forest Service will begin the treatments on Sunday, with burning activity expected to extend through next week. There are four separate burns planned for the series, with the largest occurring near the Happy Jack area south of Flagstaff. Officials say moderate smoke is expected. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
It seems that one concern the judge has.
Today is the last of a scheduled four-day civil contempt hearing for Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio before federal judge Murray Snow. Yesterday, Arpaio made a surprising admission from the stand. He admitted his office was involved in a secret investigation related to federal judges, including Judge Snow, and he testified his lawyers had separately hired a private agent to investigate alleged comments made by the judge's wife. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block has covered the entire hearing and joins us from downtown Phoenix. Jude explains what the fallout from yesterday's revelation was.
It seems that one concern the judge has is that at this moment in time, when he's focused on trying to clean house at the sheriff's office and really get this agency in shape, the guy who was used to be in charge of the division that would do these kinds of investigations just got promoted to be the head of the Professional Standards Bureau. So that's something Judge Snow is asking about. But what is clear is that at this point, this question of the sheriff investigating the judge is separate from the contempt hearing. The direct connection hasn't been made yet, so this seems to be sort of some kind of separate inquiry that's going on, and it probably won't impact the judge's findings about whether or not the sheriff committed civil contempt of court by violating his orders.
Jude, the sheriff has had a history of investigating, some have called it intimidating, political rivals in the past, and that included Maricopa County supervisors and judges. What might the sheriff have been thinking in these investigations that came out yesterday into the judge and Mrs. Snow?
Well, in the case of Judge Snow's wife, the sheriff was responding to a tip that she had apparently been overheard saying something to the effect of that the judge didn't want to see Arpaio get reelected. And Arpaio might have been trying to verify that, to try to gather evidence that perhaps this judge is biased against him and should be recused. After all, this judge has forced Arpaio to change a lot about how he does business and change his agency. And so he really doesn't have a bigger rival than Snow. So, that could be one motivation. Of course, we don't know. So that's purely speculation.
Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan was the only person to testify this morning. In a nutshell, what stood out about his testimony?
The testimony this morning was focused on the original contempt of court issues. The ACLU's attorney was grilling Sheridan about something that happened in May of 2014. That was when it came out that sheriff's deputies had been filming their traffic stops, but had never turned over any of those videos to the plaintiffs in this racial profiling case. So the court helped the sheriff's office devise a plan for how to subtly recover those videos without deputies being tempted to destroy the evidence. But while that plan was being devised, Sheridan apparently directed Chief David Trombi to send out an email to all the supervisors instructing them to collect those videos, which completely frustrated the plan. Sheridan ultimately told the Monitor about the email, but he acted like it was a mystery for why that email ever got sent out. He didn't take responsibility that he had, in fact, given that order. Since this issue is all coming down to intent, the ACLU on the stand was trying to kind of point out the inconsistencies in Sheridan's story. At one point, it got very tense, and he told the lawyer, "Be careful about calling me a liar." And he cited migraines that he's been suffering as for why he had some difficulties recalling events that day.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thank you.
Thank you.
Eight Valley cities and towns decided to do a special mid-decade census this year, but now there's a chance that may not happen. The League of Arizona Cities and Towns is in a meeting right now to try and come up with a solution to the problem. KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan has been following the issue. So, Alex, what is this whole fight about?
Well, it's about the money. The state divides its revenue from income, sales, and other taxes among different cities and towns. So the Department of Revenue does this based on federal population data from the U.S. Census, and they do their census every 10 years. So smaller cities that thought they've had a lot of population growth since 2010 signed up to do this recount so they could theoretically get a higher share of state money. So these eight Valley cities, which are Goodyear, Queen Creek, Buckeye, Chandler, Gilbert, Peoria, Surprise, and Maricopa, all decided to do this census. Then other cities that are bigger, like Phoenix and Mesa, weren't so sure about their decision not to do it, so they kind of didn't want to be left out.
So can the cities who already signed up for the federal census then opt out?
They can, but it could be expensive. So, for example, Peoria estimates it's going to cost the city $3 million to do the census. So at any point in time, Peoria can drop out of this special census, but it will not get the money back that it has already spent, but it can get the portion of the $3 million the Federal Census Bureau has not yet spent back. So they'll get a portion back.
As you mentioned, the census is traditionally done every 10 years. Has this ever been a problem before?
Yes, it has, but they came up with some kind of solution. In 2005, the state passed a law that allowed the Department of Revenue to use state population data to divide state money. Some cities had expressed interest in doing that again this year, but not enough cities wanted to do it, so it didn't pass.
So how does the state data then differ from the traditional census data?
The U.S. Census Bureau tries to count every single person in whatever place they are doing the census. The state population estimates are done a little bit differently. They're counted from different records, like birth and death records, public school enrollment, driver's license, Social Security records, and then the state demographer extrapolates that data to come up with a population estimate. Now, there's talk about adding another way for a state demographer, Jim Chang, to do his population estimates.
We have been talking about trying to get water utility data, but without the cooperation of cities, that's impossible. But now it seems like there is some incentive among the cities to take on this project.
Chang says while this could be a very good way to get an accurate population estimate, it's not a simple process because utility companies keep records in a different way than other state records, so it would require a lot of work.
KJZZ's Alexandra Olgan. Alex, thanks.
Thanks.
Arizona public school students have been taking the AZ Merit Test. The testing window ends early next month. This is the replacement for the state's former standardized test called AIMS. To find out how it's going, we call on Joe Thomas. He's a U.S. government teacher at Skyline High School in Mesa and vice president of the Arizona Education Association.
It's gone pretty well. I mean, it's a disruption. Anytime you move away from the day-to-day class schedule, it's going to be a disruption. But it's been a pretty manageable one. We have a lot of people that are working on it, trying to get the schedule set. The difficulty is we're one of two high schools in Mesa that are piloting the computer version of the AZ Merit Test. And the idea is that's supposed to streamline the results and make it somewhat easier to take. And this is the first year, so there's always those first-year implementations. But our biggest challenge this year is we have more students than we have computers.
How does the disruption with this test compare to the disruption that schools and your school maybe in particular saw with AIMS?
Well, aims we had done for several years. And so the short answer is a pen and paper test, as long as you have enough test booklets, enough answer documents, and enough number two pencils for students, everything's great. You can test them all at the same time. You just have to have them kind of sectioned off into the different classrooms. This one, the technology is the limitation.
How much of the disruptions that you're seeing do you attribute to this is the first time you're doing AZ Merit, you're working out a lot of the wrinkles, you didn't necessarily know everything to expect, versus sort of maybe inherent problems with the test or how students take the test, things like that?
Yeah, that's a really good question because you learn so much in your first year. And I have to say that we haven't had too many glitches, but there's little things. We found out that if you don't have the headphones plugged in to the computer as you log in, the headphones don't work. It has to do with the security around the browser. And so there's little hardware and software issues that you learn, but that's disrupting the student's test. There's software issues that will have to be addressed by the vendor, and I'm sure they will. That's part of a first-year rollout. Most of it is first-year stuff, first-year implementation, and most of it is small. But again, you want to make sure you minimize that as much as possible so the students can have test results that really reflect a positive climate that they were taking the test in and not a lot of disruptions.
Have you heard anything from colleagues in other districts or other parts of the state about how this rollout is going, either the paper and pencil version or a computer version in other districts?
I've heard just a little bit because we've just started. There's a colleague I have, an English teacher at Mesquite High School. They did the computer version. They got through it in about a week or just over a school week. That tells me they have a lot more computers or they found a way to extend the day or, you know, it worked wonderfully. And she even said it was very smooth. I heard from a parent board member that the test showed up the day after the first scheduled day of testing at his son's school. And there are things that you can control and things you can't, and, you know, you shift that schedule, but that's a pretty good disruption. So it's a rollout year, and everybody's adjusting as best they can. Arizona's in the midst of a real focus on testing, and testing is important. No teacher's going to tell you it's not. But it doesn't tell you everything about the kid, and we've got to remember that our primary role there is teaching and learning, and we need to be able to get through these tests in a manageable amount of time and get back to what we do every day, which is work with kids, get them from point A to point B. So you could talk to 50 different teachers in 50 different schools and get a lot of different stories, but I've not heard horror stories at all. Most of them have been fairly positive or at least issues that would be reasonable. Those are real issues, but I think that people are going to be able to work through them.
Joe Thomas is a U.S. government teacher at Skyline High School in Mesa. He's also vice president of the Arizona Education Association. Joe, thank you so much.
No, thank you, Mark.
Still to come, Glendale is looking to sell some of the buildings it owns.
They've gone through some financial challenges in recent years, which is probably no secret. And this was seen as another way to raise revenue, which could help them to meet their financial goals.
What's on the block? Coming up, it's the show.
We did have some rain earlier today around the valley, and the chance for rain continues tomorrow when there's a 60% chance. We're looking for a high temperature of 83, and then for Sunday, 30% chance for rain with a high of 77. Currently, it's partly cloudy, 69 degrees at KJZZ. In Valley traffic, watch out for a number of accidents, especially in the East Valley, 101 southbound at Guadalupe, also 101 northbound at Elliott, the 60 eastbound at the 101, and a couple of other collisions to avoid on the 202 westbound at the 51, also I-17 northbound at the Peoria Avenue off-ramp. You're listening to the show at 217.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, presenting the new 2015 Subaru Legacy, the 36 MPG midsize sedan redefined, ready now for test drives. Shop Subaru.com.
The Institute of Museum and Library Services this week awarded its National Medal for Museum and Library Service to 10 institutions around the country. The Museum of Northern Arizona in Flagstaff was one of them. Robert Brunig is the museum's president.
For us, it is just an incredible recognition of our efforts over many years to engage with our community in a multiple and meaningful ways. So just to give you some examples, we have, you know, lots of really strong and robust programs for kids in the summer that try to connect kids to this place. More recently, we started a program, a Navajo language program for Navajo kids called Diné Discovery. In the summer months, we have, and in the fall, four major heritage festivals, each one about a particular culture. Our whole purpose is to promote cross-cultural dialogue, communication, and information about specific Native cultures, or in the case of the fall program, the Latino cultures of Northern Arizona. So the museum tries to engage and reach out in the community in a variety of ways, stimulate thinking about our future, stimulate thinking about the region in which we live, promote dialogue between different parts of the community. And I think this award is in recognition of all of those systematic efforts to communicate and reach out to our community.
When you look at how to program the museum in general, how do you sort of balance trying to be a part of and appeal to your particular community in Flagstaff and Northern Arizona more broadly, but also have exhibits and other programs that appeal to people who are not from that part of the state, or maybe not even from Arizona?
Well, that's a really good question. And our long-term exhibits are more geared to people who are passing through the region and or people from other parts of the world. And so, you know, what we do is we have our what would be called, although nothing is ever permanent, our long-term or permanent exhibits that are more general and reach a more general audience than the tourists. But then the public programs we have are very much targeted at our own community and engaging with our own community about issues and, you know, activities or cultures that are, you know, are part of Northern Arizona.
Does a museum like yours have maybe a slightly different role given where you are geographically and sort of the population centers around you than a museum might have in the Phoenix area?
Yes, I think we see our role as holding up lenses of science and art to our region. We're a place-based, place-specific institution. So we see our role as to look at our region through a variety of what I call lenses, the lenses of science, the lenses of art, and through the different sciences, and, you know, just try to get people to foster deeper connections to this place.
Do you think winning something like this will help you maybe do more of that down the road?
I certainly hope so. Well, I think first of all, it calls attention to what we've been doing, and it says our peer group at a national level really respects our institution and respects the things that we do, and that can only help us build more support and engagement with the museum down the road. And we're going to take every opportunity we can to use this in that way.
Robert Brunig is president of the Museum of Northern Arizona. The institution just received the 2015 National Medal for Museum and Library Service from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Robert, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Traditional symphonic music gets a dose of hard rock tonight when the Phoenix Symphony presents the music of Led Zeppelin. Symphony CEO Jim Ward says it's part of an effort to broaden the audience.
We wanted to be able to bring the music that people know and love, but present it in a way that they probably never heard before, which is with a live full symphony. And believe me, it's a different kind of an experience. And so we dipped our toe in the water last season with a show, The Music of the Rolling Stones, that was sold out, a smashing success. So thus was born the Legend series.
Does that rest with some of your classical subscribers as well, your more traditional subscribers? Or are you finding you're getting more new folks involved with this?
Well, both, Steve. Actually, we have we're flexible. We want to have people enjoy us in any way they possibly would want. What we also find is that patrons that come and sample us, if you will, for the first time through like a Legend series are so excited by that they often will come back and buy just another ticket to another type of show and then get hooked and kind of do the choose your own thing as well.
Do you concern yourself with whether it is generating ticket sales to other things, or can you sort of rest and say to some extent, this was a smashing success, so it's okay even if this was a one-off for some people?
Yes, absolutely. And we do all of those analytics, Steve. You know, in a classics concert, what we call new to files, new to our database, people that are there for the first time, the percentages you might guess are relatively low, although we've increased that over the past couple of years. But with a show like the music of Led Zeppelin, those new-to-file percentages increased greatly. And then what we can do is target those individuals with follow-ups, offers and communications that hopefully invite them back to similar concerts or other concerts. And we can track absolutely their behavioral pattern. And there is a revenue stream. There's a tail on that that works out for us.
Could the symphony thrive without trying different things?
No. No, this is a critical time for symphonies across the country, and it's certainly not unique in the history of symphonies, but you know, we have to evolve and adapt our art form, particularly for younger audiences who, and when I say younger audiences, the return on an investment of getting a person maybe who's 24 years old who isn't necessarily inclined to classical music to kind of turn away from Lady Gaga and come to a Mahler concert, probably not very efficient. However, those under 40, you know, we do need to plant those seeds.
Jim Ward, CEO of the Phoenix Symphony. Jim, thanks.
Thanks so much, Steve.
You have a favorite Led Zeppelin song?
Oh, my gosh, Steve. Led Zeppelin is truly one of my favorite groups of all time. And, of course, I always enjoyed the classic Stairway to Heaven simply because that was the slow dance as I was growing up, and it would allow you to have a slow dance with your date.
Glendale is looking to sell off some of its buildings. The city has been dealing with financial problems for several years. Sterling Fluherty is a staff writer for the Glendale Star and wrote the story about Glendale trying to offload some property.
In a nutshell, the city wanted to liquidate some of its assets. They've gone through some financial challenges in recent years, which is probably no secret. And this was seen as another way to raise revenue, which could help them to meet their financial goals.
Do you have any sense of how much money they could potentially raise from doing this?
Well, as I went through the RFP, the indication was that the city had spent maybe around $50 million for the 10 buildings in question. Now, of course, depreciation could reduce the value, or depending on the market, it could increase the value. I think part of the reason the city issued the RFP was to find a professional real estate consultant who could do the very best job of telling the city just in fact what these properties were worth and their likelihood of selling on the open market.
Which buildings are we talking about here?
Well, at the start of the list, and the list may have been alphabetical, but I think it maybe captured the imagination, was the Bank of America building, which is virtually across the street from City Hall. It's maybe four, five, six stories tall. It used to have several city departments. Now there's the Chamber of Commerce there and a few other tenants. In addition to that, there's a city court site that the city started building but never finished. There's a St. Vincent's DePaul kind of building. There's various other buildings that are either vacant now, like an old museum, or maybe were never developed, like a lot that was going to be used for a water treatment plant, I believe.
We're not talking like City Hall here.
Right. So the city did its due diligence, you might say, through a series of workshops over the last 2.5 years. They said, we have critical service function buildings like City Hall, like the fire department, like the police department, and those aren't going anywhere. But then there are these in-between buildings that could maybe have a private-public kind of partnership. And they thought, well, maybe the libraries, maybe community services, maybe arenas. And then they got to this third category of buildings that were just not being utilized or underutilized. And they decided those were likely the most eligible. And then they're looking to this real estate firm to help them make those determinations and then to follow through on the actual sale.
Is there a sense of what the timeline on this process might be? I mean, when these buildings might be sold, if they're going to be sold?
Yeah. So I was looking through the RFP, which I obtained from the city, and it turns out that the firm, once they obtain a contract from the city, which could happen as soon as next month with approval of the city council, will have a first phase of about 60 days to do the market analysis. And then they're given a six-month period during which they're supposed to sell the 10 buildings that have been identified as priorities. They'll get a flat fee during the first 60 days, and then there's a commission available if they can deliver within that first half year.
Sterling Fluharty is a staff writer for the Glendale Star. He wrote the story about Glendale looking to sell some of its buildings. Sterling, thanks so much.
You bet. I appreciate the time here with you.
This week, police arrested Phoenix Mercury star Brittany Griner and her fiancé Glory Johnson of the WNBA's Tulsa Shock on assault and disorderly conduct charges. The incident is considered a domestic violence offense. According to reports, Griner told police the couple was having relationship problems.
Domestic violence involving athletes has been in the news a lot lately, but people don't often think or talk about it when both people involved are women. To talk more about this, we turn to Alicia Durfee, Associate Professor and Graduate Director of Women and Gender Studies at ASU School of Social Transformation.
I mean, it's complicated, obviously, right? I mean, it is the same conversation in the sense of domestic violence is never okay. Any form of violence in any intimate relationship is never okay. And therefore, we should say that, you know, women are not allowed to do it, men are not allowed to do it, and it shouldn't occur in any type of relationship. At the same time, we know that the violence perpetrated by men is often different than the violence perpetrated by women. Not always, but if you look at broad patterns, there are often differences in the motivation for the violence, the context of the violence, and importantly, the consequences of that violence on the victim.
Do you think that the WNBA can take any lessons from other leagues, the NFL and others, that have dealt with this, or is this its own sort of situation with this particular league?
I hope that WNBA can be a leader here. I think the NFL has done a lot of really good work. I think the NFL still has a long way to go. I know the National Organization of Women critiqued the NFL policy because it's not victim-centered, and I think that's a pretty valid criticism. Whenever you have a policy that focuses exclusively on the offender and is exclusively kind of consequences, what you miss is the opportunities for prevention. You miss opportunities to provide victims resources. You miss the opportunities to have conversations as to you know, how to really support the victim and what in whatever he or she wants to do.
The WNBA is a league that really markets itself as a family-friendly environment. A lot of the fans are young people, especially young girls. Does this incident, and regardless of sort of how it plays out in the legal system, does this in some way impact the league going forward, do you think?
I think this is, again, an opportunity for them to be a leader in how, you know, athletics, which is honestly, it's a sport that often is associated, any sport, with violence, right? You really are aggressive on the court. So how do we train players to be aggressive on the court and remember that there's a boundary around that court? And you leave the court when you're feeling frustrated, when you feel aggressive, how do you control that and express it in very different ways and in constructive ways? So learning to talk about your feelings, learning how to handle conflict. I do see that the WNBA said that the two of them had gone to couples counseling recently because there's been a lot of conflicts around marriage. We actually, a lot of research suggests that's not the best idea. Actually, what's best when you have this type of violent relationship is that both individuals see therapists separately and address the separate issues that are going on. The victim, how do we support that victim? What does she need to move forward? And then for the perpetrator, you know, what is motivating this action? Why is there this need for power and control? And how do you handle that? And those conversations need to happen outside of that couple environment.
Alicia Durfee is an associate professor and graduate director of Women and Gender Studies at ASU School of Social Transformation.
Still to come, mapping out how congressional districts around the country score on health, income, and education.
Income inequality has really come forcefully on the agenda today, but what's getting overshadowed in this discussion is inequalities of opportunity that people often don't even know exist.
That's ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. A lot of accidents to watch out for on the Valley freeways at this hour. We'll start in the West Valley, I-10 westbound at Avondale Boulevard. The right lane is blocked. Also a collision, I-17 northbound at the Peoria Avenue off-ramp. Other accidents, 202 westbound at 24th Street. The 60 westbound at Priest, that one's blocking the right lane. And on the 101 northbound in the East Valley, an accident at Elliott and another southbound at Guadalupe. Still a chance for some more rain tonight around the valley. It becomes a 60% chance by tomorrow night. We expect a high tomorrow of 83 degrees. Currently, relative humidity is at 56%, partly cloudy, and 69 at 2:34.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business with the highest-ranked MBA in Arizona according to U.S. News & World Report. MBA Preview Day takes place Saturday, May 2nd. Registration at mbapreviewday.com.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Tensions are high in Baltimore as protesters promise a massive demonstration tomorrow following the death of a man who sustained life-ending injuries after his arrest. Freddie Gray apparently experienced an acute spinal injury after he was loaded into a police van and later died. Details are unclear. Six Baltimore police officers have been suspended with pay. Federal and local authorities are investigating. Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batt says some details are known at this time.
We know he was not buckled in the transportation wagon as he should have been. No excuses for that, period. We know our police employees failed to get him medical attention in a timely manner multiple times.
Batts warned the city of Baltimore will not tolerate outside agitators. A Wisconsin man has entered a not guilty plea to a federal charge stemming from allegations that he tried to join the so-called Islamic State. From member station WUWM in Milwaukee, Marty Michelson reports the punishment could be up to 15 years in prison.
Prosecutors have charged 34-year-old Joshua Van Haften with trying to provide material assistance to a foreign terrorist organization. He was arrested at O'Hare International Airport in Chicago earlier this month. Authorities say Van Haften had flown back to the U.S. from Turkey after a failed attempt to join ISIS in Syria. Van Haften appeared in court on Friday for an arraignment. His attorney entered a not guilty plea on his behalf. A federal judge scheduled another court proceeding for May. For NPR News, I'm Marty Michelson in Milwaukee.
On Wall Street, the Nasdaq closed at a record high, up 36 at 5,092. The S&P 500 also set a record, rising 4 points, and the Dow closed up 21. This is NPR.
The Valley's canal system isn't identified with romance and beauty like those in Venice or Amsterdam. It's more utilitarian than that. But ASU student Will Novak is trying to change it one little bit at a time. Novak received an ASU Innovation Challenge grant worth $2,000 to help beautify the canals. He's going to start with the section of Grand Canal from Central Avenue to 7th Street.
Phoenix has always been a canal city, going back to the days of the Hohokam Indians, and then the early Phoenicians were much more canal-centric. Their communities were really built facing the canals. People would swim in the canals and water ski in the canals. They were really sort of a system of linear public parks, and I'm a native, and I've always been interested in that.
Now, Will, I'm almost a native. We moved here when I was 4, so be gentle on this. When you look at the canals right now, what do you think of? What words come to mind, and what words would you like to come to mind?
Oh, right now, they're crummy and full of shopping carts, and they're, for the most part, there's a few okay ones. The words I would like to come to mind are beautiful and romantic and walkable. I think when you think of a city, and maybe this is on my mind because I just got married a month ago, so I'm in sort of a romantic frame of mind, but if you can't think of your city, when you think of your city, if you can't think of 5 or 10 places where it would be a good place to ask someone to marry you, you've kind of failed as a city. We should have these beautiful linear parks all throughout our city. We have 181 miles of canals. That's more than Venice and Amsterdam combined. And if they were these beautiful green spaces, it would be similar to Boston's Emerald Necklace or something like that. And I that's what I would love to see someday.
Are we in a situation where you just think people have neglected them?
People have. And we, I think in the starting in the 1950s after the war, the future and progress and infrastructure sort of became more important than the softer side of things in life. And so, you know, getting water where it needed to get was more important than also making it a valuable public space. So it is obviously in the desert, water is king, and it's important to get the water places in an efficient manner, but that doesn't mean we also can't have nice places along the way to ride our bicycles, walk our dogs, stroll with our loved ones.
And do you want to have contributions from whether it's folks at high schools or folks in the neighborhood and sort of giving them kind of ownership and thus creating more value from that?
Exactly. Yeah. It's sort of the Jane Jacobs model of city building versus the Robert Moses top-down power broker. This, my vision is more of the community leads the way with approval, of course, from SRP. SRP controls the canals. So without their blessing, it doesn't go anywhere. But they've shown me some interest and they're open to it. They've really done a lot of good things in recent years, putting in crosswalks so that you don't have to play Frogger with your life to get onto the canal. So they've been helpful. And so with their blessing, I hope to have the community be able to sort of make it their own place. Because when the community is involved in a place, it's has a more lasting impact. You know, it's what they wanted to see, and they'll help grow and nurture it.
ASU student Will Novak on his plan to improve the valley's canals. Kirby Hoyt is president of Phoenix-based Edge Industries. He's a landscape designer and landscape urbanist. He says an important element in changing how people use the canals and their banks is making them feel safer.
If people feel they're safe and they feel they can be out there without any chance of any harm, that's going to be the thing that can really help activate them. So anybody that's thinking about doing anything really needs to put that idea of safety first, if you will, getting the eyes on the canal.
Is that something that, if it moves forward, would have to be kind of a commitment of various stakeholders, whether it's the city, whether it's private people with interesting ideas and homeowners as well?
Definitely. One of the things that the city is already starting to do, there's a canal, there was an RFP canal out for the Grand Canal from 15th Avenue over to, I think, 16th Street, and then another piece over by 32nd Street down to 40th Street over by the Gateway Community College, where they're looking at a revitalization plan and how to make those more active. And one of the things that the city is taking a bold step in doing is activating the intersections, making those crossings from one side of the street to the other visible, safe, making it very well connected. So that's, I think that's the first step from the public standpoint and what they can do. From a private standpoint, I mean, it's hard to say what those can look like or feel like. If people like living at the beach and having the beach in their front yard and don't mind all the people walking by on the boardwalk or on the strand, well, then in a sense, they could have that type of opportunity. But if you've got people that say they want their privacy and they have those walls up so they can, you know, have their privacy by their pool or whatever it is back there in their backyard, they might leave those things up. But from a privatization standpoint, opening that up, I think, to the views of the canal can make it feel safer. And it makes it more interesting for the people walking along there rather than walking along a, you know, just this long linear set of masonry walls. Being able to look in some of the backyards, almost like people that walk on sidewalks and looking at people on their front porches. And since people use their backyards now much more than they do front porches, it's kind of that old school sense of, you know, the new community type of thing.
Without comparing us too much again to Venice or Amsterdam, are there other cities or communities that come to mind to you that have done this well or have done something similar well?
That's a really tough question for you to answer. The closest thing I can kind of think of would be where you could look at rails to trail system of railroad tracks, because most of the time they're kind of faced behind the systems, behind the main infrastructure and the residences and so forth. So I think that's probably the strong place to look for good examples of where people have been able to make a strong change in the system.
Kirby Hoyt, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Kirby Hoyt, president of Phoenix-based Edge Industries.
A new report looks at how each congressional district in the country fares as far as education, health, and income. The study by the group Measure of America ranks the districts based on the American Human Development Index. Researchers use congressional districts because they all include roughly the same number of people. Sarah Bird Sharps is co-director of Measure of America and co-author of the report called Geographies of Opportunity.
We pay a lot of attention to money metrics like GDP, which is, of course, very important for knowing how the economy is doing. But it's really giving us misleading signals on how ordinary people are doing. So the American Human Development Index is aiming to provide this information, spotlighting inequalities in three basic areas, health, education, and earnings. And on this measure, there's really astonishing variation, even within one state like Arizona.
I'm curious about what you found in Arizona, because it looks like for a lot of the districts, things are not looking all that great.
Overall, as a state, Arizona's pretty much right in the middle. So the American Human Development Index measures well-being on a scale from 0 to 10, and Arizona's just about a 5. But just like we find across the nation, often the biggest well-being gaps are actually within states and sometimes even within metro areas, more than between them, between states. And that absolutely holds true in Arizona as well. So Arizona, of course, has 9 congressional districts, and both the highest district in terms of well-being and the lowest are in the Phoenix metro area. So District 6, which is in northeast suburbs of Phoenix, ranks 46th in terms of the 436 congressional districts in the United States. On the other hand, District 7, which ranks 416th. So that's a huge divide between them. And, I mean, what does that mean in terms of people's lives? Well, in District 6, the typical worker can expect to earn in the $37,000 range, whereas in District 7, typical worker can expect to earn about $22,000. Huge, huge disparity between those two within one city. And in terms of education, also really enormous differences.
How did you find the disparity between the top and bottom performing districts in Arizona relative to other states?
Well, I think that within each state, there are big highs and big lows. What's particularly surprising in Arizona is that they're adjacent to each other. So that's quite surprising. And I think the other thing that really stands out is that education is a critical piece in here. Educational attainment rates very low in the 7th district, and it starts really early. I was trying to see sort of what's the root of a bit of this. And one of the things that's really clear is that from very young, the rate of kids in school is very different.
In your perfect world, how would these numbers and how would this data be used?
Well, we do this work for policymakers, but also for philanthropic organizations and business leaders and others to understand better, you know, what's going on in the places that they care about and what are the most important actions that they can take to sort of invest in everybody, what we call it, an infrastructure of opportunity for all of the people living there. And I think, you know, for Arizona, what's really clear is that the Latino population has tremendously low earnings and that they're also the fastest growing population in the state. And so investing in the future of Arizona means investing in those kids.
Sarah Bird Sharps is co-director of Measure of America and co-author of Geographies of Opportunity. Sarah, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
A 1,000 feet of vinyl will be covering a street near you.
But don't worry, you don't have to drive on it. It's for sliding, set up by a traveling event called Slide the City. The show's Annika Klein found out more about this enormous slide and the enormous amount of water it uses.
Before I tell you about that slide, let's take a look back at its predecessor.
Okay, everybody, come outside. Everybody ready for a wild, wet ride?
Slip, slip and slide.
You might remember the slip and slide from your own childhood. It's basically a 16-foot-long yellow plastic sheet. You spray water onto it from the garden hose to make it slippery. Then you just need a running start and...
slip, slip and slide.
So take that concept, multiply it by about 60, and you have the slide created by JSC Events, a Salt Lake City-based startup. The 3-lane slide takes up an entire street, and it needs a little more than a garden hose. Emily Clifford Sanchez is with Slide the City and says the slide uses about 15,000 gallons of water in a day. But she says the trick is that they clean and reuse the same 15,000 gallons during an event.
So there would never be a time when there would just be water pouring out, because that would be completely irresponsible and a total waste.
This weekend, the slide will roll out on Palisades Boulevard in Fountain Hills. It'll be the first Slide the City event in Arizona, with more to come. That's in stark contrast to neighboring California, which has so far refused to hold Slide the City events due to concerns about water conservation. But Fountain Hills Recreation Supervisor Rachel Goodwin says the 15,000 gallons of water aren't just going down the drain at the end of the day.
The water after the event will likely go through the sanitation district and be reused, most likely through our golf courses.
Or even the 330-foot-tall fountain for which the town gets its name. It's the show. I'm Annika Klein.
Slide the City will be in Fountain Hills tomorrow and in downtown Phoenix on May 16th.
Good afternoon. You're listening to The Show, a KJZZ original production, mixing news and features from the Valley, the region, along with national and even international news to provide you a stream of engaging radio.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting the music of Led Zeppelin, live with a full rock band alongside the Phoenix Symphony, one night only, April 24th. Info at phoenixsymphony.org.
According to the ASPCA, approximately 4 million dogs enter animal shelters in the United States every year, but less than half of them are successfully adopted. As KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins reports, a relatively common practice at shelters could be preventing some of those dogs from finding homes.
What's in a name? That which we call a rose by any other name would smell as sweet.
Despite Juliet's wishful thinking, names matter. A name carries all sorts of connotations. It's how one identifies with their family and traces their lineage. At one point in time, a name could arouse such animosity that, well, you know the story, it could lead to tragedy. But we've come a long way from the Montagues and the Capulets.
The days when you could say, well, I won't talk to him or her because she's a member of this or that race or ethnic group, and we don't approve of that anymore among people. That was a misguided view of humankind. Well, I think it's a misguided view of dogkind as well.
Dr. Clive Wynn spends a lot of time thinking about dog kind and their behavior, the kind of characteristics that can make a dog man's best friend or potentially unadoptable. He runs the Canine Science Collaboratory at Arizona State University.
Our mission is to better understand the relationship between people and their dogs, and that extends into understanding the relationship between dogs and their wild ancestors.
Over time, Wynn thinks about 15,000 years, wolves evolved into the hundreds of breeds of dogs we know today. Through selective breeding, humans have assigned dogs different sets of traits and behaviors.
So we know, for example, that border collies are a herding breed of dog, and most border collies, given half a chance, will round up anything else that's in the house. They'll round up the cat, they'll round up the children, right? That's a typical herding dog behavior.
But other dogs were bred to display a more aggressive type of behavior.
The pit that the pit bull is named for is the fighting pit, where people threw dogs together to fight each other, and some people regrettably still do.
While dogfighting is now less common, the stigma of a frightening, powerful, aggressive dog is still associated with pit bulls and their name. And that name is a heavy burden on the dogs, especially when they show up in a shelter.
It can be difficult to place pit bull breeds because the negative stereotypes are very high.
Michael Moorfield is the shelter operations manager at the Animal Welfare League in Phoenix. He says pit bulls have the highest euthanasia rates and the longest lengths of stay in Maricopa County shelters.
Now, pit bull's actually not a breed. It's not a German Shepherd. It's not a Chesapeake Bay Retriever. It's not a Dachshund. It is a larger category of dogs and makes up about 25 different breeds.
So at the Animal Welfare League, when staff identify dogs, they use a more specific breed to describe a dog with pit bull characteristics, like American Staffordshire Terrier. Most shelters can't afford to DNA test every dog they receive, so they rely on an educated staff to label breeds based on physical characteristics.
It's just very difficult because there are so many mixed breeds that you are basically ascribing characteristics of a purebred animal to something that could be third, fourth, fifth generation mixed breed, and then trying to determine that just by looking at it.
Aside from being difficult, labeling a shelter dog a specific breed can also have a major effect on a dog's adoptability. Lisa Gunter studies shelters like the Animal Welfare League for her research at the Canine Science Collaboratory. She says a shelter in Florida recently removed breed labels from their kennel cards and from their online adoption profiles.
We looked at over 17,000 records from the year before when they had breed labels to when they got rid of breed labels, and we looked at the dogs' adoption numbers and length of stay.
She says the results were dramatic.
We found that with adoptions, the pit bull dogs, their adoptions increased by 72%. And all dogs in the shelter, in every breed group, that was AKC breed groups, increased. So that was fantastic. It wasn't just that pit bulls benefited, but everybody benefited.
Gunter acknowledges that not all shelters may be inclined to remove breed labels because they serve as a kind of useful shorthand, but her research suggests that they may be doing more harm than good. Dr. Wynn says when you take the emphasis off the breed and you let people focus on the behavioral characteristics of an individual dog, the opportunities for a connection and a successful adoption will increase.
Don't let yourself be swayed largely or perhaps at all by the label that says that this dog is in principle that breed or whatever. Actually meet Fido, you know, give him a chance.
Because there's so much more to Fido than a name. Jimmy Jenkins, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
If you had to find old state records or photographs, would you know where to go? Well, they're located in a modern facility created to withstand time. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez takes us there.
The Polly Rosenbaum State Archives and History Building is located near the state capitol. It is the home of the Arizona Archives. This is where Arizona's permanent government records are stored. Did you know the Rosenbaum Building is one of the most secure government structures in the state?
In 2009, when this building opened, it was the most modern state archive building in the entire country.
Dennis Preisler is assistant director of the State Archives branch.
The reason it has to be so secure is because this is about people's lives. But it really is about protecting the records of the citizens of the state of Arizona.
The building is named after Polly Rosenbaum, the longest serving Arizona state legislator, representing Gila County for 45 years. From the outside, the two-story Rosenbaum building looks like a modern structure, but inside, it's more like a vault. This 134,000-square-foot facility is constructed with 1-foot-thick concrete walls and 16-inch-thick concrete floors.
A lot of times they'll be wearing coats and caps and gloves and that sort of thing because it's so cold.
It is cold in here.
The storage rooms are called pods and are kept at 55 degrees to properly preserve the documents. These are rooms the size of a grand ballroom with about 24-foot ceilings.
How big and how much material we have.
Whoa! This is huge!
This is the collection of archive permanent.
The pods are lined with tall shelves with thousands of boxes extending from one end of the room to the other. There are more than 15 miles of removable shelving in the building.
We have all of the governors from back to the territorial days. We keep the Secretary of State's office papers. We have all the major state agencies if they're deemed permanent. And the interesting thing is this was so well designed that most people can't notice it, but the floor is slightly sloped, so if water does get in here, it drains away.
On the first floor, there's a conservation room where documents and photographs are treated and restored, and a triage room where items are checked for small problems.
We have a very active pest control system. We monitor it. We don't want any pests or anything in here because that's all bad.
Preisler says the most commonly requested information are family documents. So if you're looking for your genealogy in Arizona, you could very well find information here. All these documents are made available to the public. Oh, the oldest item stored at the Arizona Archives is a map from 1579. It's of what was believed North America and Asia looked like back then. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or know things that we really should know, please tell us about them. The show at KJZZ.org.
For a lot of guys, the Pinewood Derby may conjure up ideas of Cub Scouts and one of your first major engineering projects.
But for some of us, it was a time that, not unlike Science Fair, started off as a fun project but ended up being taken over by our dads.
Well, one local Phoenix business has decided to change those memories and turn the Pinewood Derby into an event for adults. This weekend, Short Leash will host the second annual Pinewood Classic, which they bill as a grown-ups-only Pinewood Derby race in the heart of downtown Phoenix. Dwight Knowlton is getting ready for his second race. The Phoenix designer and author creates illustrated books about vintage racing cars. So creating a model car seemed right up his alley.
Well, I'm a passionate car guy. I've had a few project cars when I was younger, so now I'm getting to build little wood ones.
Knowlton wasn't a Cub Scout, so last year was his first time in a Pinewood Derby. But that also means he isn't bringing any emotional baggage with him to the race.
You know, I don't have a history of my dad building the car for me. I got to actually, you know, my first one was last year, and I got to build it with my own skills, which was fun.
While the contest will award those who cross the finish line first, Knowlton is more in it for style points.
Last year, he made a model of a 1955 vintage Mercedes. This year, he's sticking with the classic racer theme.
I'm building a really interesting car called the Beast of Turin. It was a 1911 Fiat with a 28.5-liter four-cylinder engine in it.
And he's not just whittling on a block of wood. He's putting all his design knowledge into the process.
I actually created scale drawings, and, you know, I had to move the wheelbase around and transpose a few things, but I got a really realistic result out of it, so that was fun.
He's been working on the car in his garage in North Phoenix for the past few days.
I did the rough cutout on a scroll saw, and then I ground down the basic roundness of it.
He finished the details by hand, including a miniature version of himself and his son as passengers. Now all that's left is some touch-up and a little paint.
Knowlton thinks by the time the car's done, he'll have put in a full 24 hours.
But yeah, it's been a super fun day for me and a nice break from all the heavier stuff that I have to do.
You can catch Dwight and all the racers at the second annual Pinewood Classic at Short Leash along Roosevelt Row tomorrow afternoon. And a lot of things going on this weekend around the Valley. You will want to catch some of them, including Roger Klein and the Peacemakers playing poolside at Talking Stick Resort. That's tonight at 8.
The Diamondbacks host the Pirates for a weekend series. That's at Chase Field tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday afternoon.
Today's show is produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, Tiara Vian, and Annika Klein. Tracy Greer, Sky Shout, and Maria Springs are our digital team. Our news director is Al Macias, and our executive producer is the shiny one, John Hoban.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have good story ideas. You can send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. For Steve Goldstein, I am Mark Brody. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Hope you have a great weekend. Stay dry out there. It's 3 o'clock.